scene setter as he does this. Know that I probably didn't make this clear previously, but the place from which Karthik is starting is not in straight line where we've come so far. So you remember at the beginning of the class, we kind of wanted to say we're going to go from zero and work our way up. We pretty much went from zero to here's how you can make some arguments for God that are logically consistent, seem to be in accord with the scientific evidence we have today, etc. But there's this gap from, okay, well, it seems like we've got good arguments for God. How do we know that this Bible is God's Bible? We are actually starting further downstream than the gap from God to the Bible. So if you're wondering why there's a gap there, it's because we've left a gap there. We're going to actually address that later. And the reason we're going to address it later is the arguments, when you try to close this gap from, okay, we believe that there's a non-material, non-spatial, personal, powerful creator of the universe, there's a lot of candidates for that today. Linking that to the Bible is a long discussion, and there's a lot of back and forth that normally has to happen. Why? Because when you go from this to Scripture, you no longer are starting at one consistent stream of here's rationality, and this is how we're going to get from rationality to this. Now you have to examine evidence, which means that you're having to take yourself in the mindset of every one of these other religions. So we could have probably legitimately 10 to 20 different significant deep conversations about how to link those two together. We're going to address that in general terms later. I will when we talk on the kind of theology class, but say what we're going to pretend for the sake of argument is that we've closed that gap, and now what we're saying is we're evaluating the Bible at this point just from a historical, scholarly, and internal perspective. So we're not saying we've disproven all these other ones, or alternately, if the Bible seems relatively reliable, then therefore all these other religions are invalid. That's not what we're saying at this point. What we're saying is let's examine the Bible and see if per the standards that we use, scholastically, historically, professionally, paleontologically, archaeologically, etc., if these seem to match. So we're starting downstream. For those of you that were concerned last time, you were right to be concerned. We probably should have made that a little bit more obvious.
Last week, we were discussing the Gospels, and I was making the argument that the Gospels are eyewitness testimony. And towards the last 10 minutes, we kind of scrambled through a lot of material, so I am going to go through that again and continue from there. So we're trying to establish that the Gospels are eyewitnesses. And we looked at a couple of critiques. Bart Ehrman was one of them, and he said that, or he claims that the Bible was transmitted over and over again, and not as eyewitness testimony, but as propaganda meant to convert people, told by people who had themselves received it 5th, 6th, or 19th hand. In fact, in his comments, he normally says that he likens the transmission of the oral tradition of the Bible to the telephone game. And just to illustrate, I'm going to have us play the telephone game. We will start with your name.
Dan.
We will end with Vince. I'm going to take a sentence, give it to Dan, and if you're not familiar with the telephone game, I whisper it to him. He's going to whisper it to the next person. We'll continue, and we'll end with Vince. So, Dan, my sentence to you is going to be, the weather is really good outside.
Okay.
Did you get it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you repeat it for me?
The weather is really good outside.
Okay. How many people think that this is going to be a really fun game? What is the point of the telephone game?
The words get changed after the message.
Yeah. So you want it to be funny, so you come up with a complicated sentence, and you make sure you whisper it, and the person says, I didn't get it. No, figure out what I told you and pass it on. Otherwise, the game's not funny. But you think that's how people talk about the good news of Jesus Christ? Or anything that is monumental. Do you go and whisper it to somebody and say, that's it, go transmit it?
Don't, but you shouldn't tell what your sentence is.
Yes.
It should be a surprise. Don't tell the rest of us.
Yes.
There's a point to the telephone game. And the point is that it not be transmitted correctly. Otherwise, it's not funny. Otherwise, Vince clearly heard what I had, and that's why Dan said, hey, turn off your mic. You're going to spoil it for us. So for Bart Ehrman to even come up with the analogy of the telephone game makes no sense, because people, and especially Christ, we don't have all of his teachings. He taught for 3 years. But we know that he probably repeated his teachings over and over and over again, because there is a lot of repetition in the Bible. Fundamental truths are repeated and presented over and over again so that we get it. And that would be the whole point. People would present the material, and even the way that Jesus spoke, some of the things that he said, like the Beatitudes, that there is a pattern to them. And therefore we can have confidence that people actually understood the material and transmitted it. So that's Bart Ehrman for you. Rudolf Bultmann said that increasing detail in oral traditions are a result of embellishment. We've been looking at the detail, a significant part of that detail are the names in the Gospels. And he says that names are the toughest things to remember, and the liberal use of names in the Gospels indicate embellishment, and we'll talk about this a little more. Richard Dawkins says that the Gospels are not reliable accounts. One of the arguments he says is that in the epistles of Paul mentions none of the alleged facts of Jesus' life. Again, why do you think that would be? Why do you think Paul would not say anything about Jesus' life?
It was fresh. Everybody was already kind of talking about it.
Maybe that's one reason, but what are the other reasons?
He wasn't one of the people that walked with him.
He's not one of the people that walked with him. Paul's conversion was much later. It was after the resurrection. It makes no sense for Paul to say that. In fact, if you look at Paul's writings, for example, in 1 Corinthians 15, there's a set of verses he has, verses 3 through 8, I believe, where he talks about the resurrection. And in his introduction to that, he says, "I am delivering to you what I have also received." And then he goes on to say that according to the scriptures, Christ died for our sins, and he rose the third day. He appeared to the 12. He appeared to 500. He also appeared to me. He's basically saying, this tradition I am passing on as I received. He makes it very clear that that was not something he's making up. And so if you look at the writings of Paul, you can see that he makes it a point to clearly delineate what is his words and what are something that he's passing down as he received it. So there's no reason to believe that Paul would actually talk about Jesus. And of course, as I pointed out last time, Dawkins' idea that nobody knows who the four evangelists were, but they almost certainly never met Jesus personally, itself is a contradiction. If he knows that, then people obviously know who the four evangelists were. So that makes no sense. All right. We also talked about the fact that in trying to establish the eyewitness testimony argument for the Gospels, we said that there seems to be a hint in the Gospels that there was a requirement that people who were witnesses to the events from the baptism of Christ to his resurrection would be the people considered authoritative in presenting the Gospels, in presenting the life of Christ. In the book of Acts, in Peter's sermon, he makes a reference to it. It is the same criteria used for selecting an apostle to replace Judas. We see this in Luke's writing. In his first introduction, he says that I am writing to you, Theophilus, and he says that I'm attempting to make an orderly account based on eyewitnesses who were there with Christ from the beginning. We see this in the writing of Mark through virtue of the fact that he has Peter, because Mark, again, remember, Mark is basically conveying to us what Peter taught. The early church tradition holds that Mark wrote down what Peter taught. And Peter is there right in the beginning after Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. And he's there through the end, especially when you consider the shorter ending of the book of Mark. You find it finishing with Peter. So we can make an argument that that idea of people present who are present from the baptism through the resurrection continues. We also see that in the book, in John's Gospel. He's not named, but there's a hint over there. So we looked at that as one aspect of it. The second aspect that we looked at was the tradition of names. I mentioned that Tal Ilan, who was a German researcher, came up with a list of 3,000 names of people who lived in that time in Israel from about 300 BC to 200 AD, and this was sourced through a number of different documents. Richard Bauckham took that list, made a few adjustments to it, basically dropping out names where names were nicknames and thus repeated. But more or less, the names remain the same. And I'm sorry, the font got switched on me, so it's probably a little difficult to read. But we have Simon as the most common name, Joseph, Eliezer, Judah, Yohanan the same as John, and Joshua the same as Jesus. So the top six names match up really well, so the modification by Bauckham was not significant. These are the top 20 names. We have some other names like Levi, Matthew, coming in to the top 20. And then I made the argument that the commonality of the names in that time matches up really well with the New Testament. So Simon is the most common name. There are eight different people mentioned with the name Simon. Joseph is also common, also in New Testament. When you look at overall statistics, actually this is for women, the top most common name, Mary, is also the most common name of people in women in the New Testament and the Gospels. And when you look at the distribution of names, 15.6% of men in that time had the name of Simon or Joseph. And we see that in Gospels and Acts, that's 18.2%. That's a pretty good correlation. And the same thing with top nine names of males. And I also mentioned that in terms of women, it's a little more, there's a lot more deviation, but that's to be expected because you have a fewer list of names to begin with. So you'll have a lot more variation. And then I made the argument that if the gospel writers were not familiar with the people, and if they were not really writing down what they heard through eyewitnesses, and if they were just making this up, because most of the allegations, they also hold that these were not written in Jerusalem or anywhere near there, that these were written by people living far away. And as one example, I mentioned that if the people were in Egypt, among the Jewish population that had settled in Egypt, they would have gotten a very different distribution of names. Simon doesn't even show up in the top list of names that were popular among the Jewish Egyptians. So not only were they familiar with the names, they most definitely talked to people from that time and they wrote it in a time frame where the names had not changed, because otherwise you would have had a different distribution of the names themselves. I also made the argument that when you compare the number of names in the Gospels versus the other so-called Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, and the Gospel of Judas, we find a stark variation. And this is interesting because the same critics who say that the New Testament Gospels are not reliable because they have so much detail and oral tradition, especially around names, I guarantee you if the New Testament Gospels were pretty sparse in names and details, they would use that very argument as a reason to reject them. They would say, hey, come on, if this were really true, if Jesus Christ was really considered Messiah, then you would think people would have a lot more detail. There's so little detail. They're going to argue both ways. But for our purposes, we have in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, 33 names, and these are names other than Jesus, other than Old Testament names, excluding the names that are mentioned in the genealogies in Matthew and Luke. We find that the Gospels are rich with names, but we find that the other Gospels, for example, Gospel of Thomas, this name, Didymus, Judas, Thomas, doesn't even make sense. In the Gospel of Mary, Jesus is not even named as Jesus. He's only referred to as the Savior. And in the Gospel of Judas, we have two real names, Judas and Jesus, and then we have 16 names from outer space. So we see that there's a stark difference between the Gospels and other writings in that area. So to take this argument further, what would you do if you had too many people with the same name? Give them modifiers. And in today's society, we generally tend to abbreviate people's name, or we say, okay, let's go by your last name. My son Luke, when he was in preschool, there was another Luke. Well, it turns out my son's last name is Abram. The other guy's last name was Abels. So they couldn't just say Luke A versus Luke. They turned the other guy into Lukey. So we make these kind of things, and we use these devices without perhaps even recognizing that we're using them. In the same way, the first century Jewish population also had techniques of modifying names and presenting names in a different way. So let's look at Simon, who is the most common name in the New Testament, in the Gospels. Can you think of any Simons that were in the Bible that you can think of offhand that were qualified, perhaps?
Pharisee.
The Pharisee Simon? Okay.
Simon Peter.
Simon Peter, yeah. Simon Peter. What does Jesus do first thing when he talks to Simon, when Simon comes over? Your name, I'm going to change your name. I'm going to call you Peter. Well, it seems like there's perhaps a reason to do that. Let's look at some verses. If I can get four volunteers to read these. Matthew 4:18, Matthew 10:4, 26:6, and Acts 9.
10:4.
Okay.
As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen.
So right there, we have Simon, and he's already been qualified, called Peter, because Jesus had named him, given him the name Peter. Okay, Matthew 10:4.
Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him.
Simon the Zealot. So now you have a qualification of Simon. He's been called Simon the Zealot. Matthew 26:6.
While Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon, a man who had a serious skin disease.
Okay, so what's your translation?
It's a Holman Christian. I'll read it in ESV.
Okay.
Now, when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper.
Acts 9:43.
So it was that he stayed many days in Joppa with Simon, a tanner.
Simon, a tanner. In that case, probably his occupation. So we see that there are a number of types of these disambiguations. In fact, when compared with what we see in literature from that time, we have a good match. There's a variant of a name, as in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon? So this is referring to the siblings of Christ, the half-siblings of Christ. And they're saying, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Well, Joseph over here, elsewhere, is actually referred to as Judas. And again, if you consider the fact that Judas is one of the most popular names, you see a reason why they would change it to be Joseph, especially writing later on, now that you know Judas Iscariot, you know, Judas the betrayer, is now infamous, you'd see why you would want to change the name from Judas to Joseph. And Joseph would perhaps be a Greek version that he took on, maybe in his lifetime, maybe before Judas became infamous. So you see examples of variations of names. And while we are at this text in Matthew 6:3, I would like to point out, in terms of contradictions and so-called lack of information, people will point out, for example, that Mark makes no reference to the virgin birth of Christ. It's mentioned in Matthew, it's mentioned in Luke. They'll point out that, hey, why did Mark leave out such an important aspect? And I would claim that this verse over here actually lends credence to the fact that this was perhaps good eyewitness reporting, because if he captured what they said accurately, they said, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Why do you think people would have said that? In a society where your lineage was always tracked to your father, we have a lot of people who called son of so-and-so. Levi, son of Alphaeus, I think is one of them, or the son of David. But over here, he's being called the son of Mary. Well, if you think about it, Mary got a vision from an angel. Joseph was told that Mary had conceived through the Lord. And how do you think everybody else took that news? Oh, really? That's a virgin birth. Exactly, we were expecting that. No, they probably were making rumors up. And so the very fact that in this verse, when he's being rejected at Nazareth, he's being called son of Mary is perhaps a term of insult. Because they're saying, we don't believe that you are even legitimate. So even in that phraseology, there is the understanding that there is something to do, there is something mysterious or perhaps suspicious with Jesus' birth. And I think that lends credence to the virgin birth itself. That's reported in Matthew and in Luke. Anyway, so moving on. Patronym added. So we have references to people qualified as son of somebody else. In Aramaic, that would be bar for son of. In Hebrew, ben. Examples, in Mark 2:14, Levi, the son of Alphaeus. So it's being qualified. In my top 20 list, you have Levi showing up as a popular name. So that makes sense that you would qualify the name. Luke chapter 3, verse 2, John, the son of Zechariah. Again, Yohanan was the fifth more popular name. So it makes sense that John, well, which John? Are you talking about John the Baptist, John the son of Zechariah? So it makes sense that it'd be qualified, and it makes sense that he would take on the name John the Baptist moving forward. Sometimes, after being called son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, that just became their name. So Bartimaeus is one of the few people who was healed by Christ, who's actually named. Lazarus is another person who was named. Bartimaeus literally means the son of Timaeus. But you can see over here how he's taken on the son of Timaeus as his name. So it's like calling him son of Timaeus, the son of Timaeus. His name became the son of Timaeus. Name of son or husband, Mary, the wife of Clopas. Again, that would make sense that Mary be qualified. The most popular name, Mary Magdalene. Again, makes sense that that would be qualified. Sometimes we also come across, and this was also found in ossuaries, and it makes sense that we find similar patterns in the Gospels. The woman is not even named. It's just named as the mother of the sons of Zebedee. That was also that also correlates with what we found in through archaeology and other research. Sometimes you have nicknames added. James the Younger. In fact, the Jewish philosopher or historian Josephus had two ancestors named Simon the Stammerer and Matthias the Hunchback. Those guys probably got those names in middle school, and it stuck with them. Sometimes you have nicknames substituted. Example, Simon Peter. Or place of origin or dwelling, Nathanael of Cana. We find that in John. You have qualification of which Nathanael you're talking about. Or a family name, Caiaphas, the high priest, was actually Joseph Bar Caiaphas, but he took on the name just Caiaphas because of family lineage. Or names in two languages. You have Silas and Silvanus. Silas is the Jewish name. Silvanus is the Greek name. Silvanus appears in Paul's writing. I think Silas appears in Acts. And so you have the same name in two different places. Simon, a tanner in Acts. So you have a qualification by occupation and so forth. So you see that the variations of names and the qualifications of names given in the Gospels seems to match with what you would expect from that society at that time. What about Jesus? The name of Jesus, as we looked at last time, was the sixth most popular name. So you'd expect that we'd have hints on the way Jesus' name is used in the Bible, and we could make some interpretation from that. And we'll look at three different questions regarding this. What is Jesus called by the narrator? So that would be the writers of the gospel. What is Jesus called by others? And what does Jesus call himself? And we'll look at these three questions, and we'll also contrast these with the other gospels. So what is Jesus called by the narrator? Well, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the chief title given to Jesus is Jesus himself. So it's Jesus. In Thomas and Judas, it's Jesus. In Philip, it's Christ. In Peter, it's Lord. Jesus is not even used in Peter. And in the Gospel of Mary, it's the Savior. And they don't use the name Jesus at all. Why is this significant? Well, let's look at a graph over here. So these are the number of times that Jesus is used as opposed to in other Gospels. It's used very infrequently. But when you look at the fact that within a few decades after Christ's resurrection, the term Jesus became not so popular among people, of especially the followers of Jesus and people who were referring to him. And if you take, for example, these are, for us, would be secular reports of Jesus. Tacitus, Pliny, and Josephus, historians who wrote and mentioned Jesus, they've already started referring to him, to the followers as Christians. Josephus actually says Jesus, who was called Christ. So very quickly, among those who were followers of Jesus and among those who knew him, the term Christ started taking hold. In fact, if you look at the comparison, this is Paul's use of Jesus versus Christ. You can see Jesus is in yellow, Christ is in red. You can see that Christ has started to dominate. Why is that important? That shows that for the New Testament writers, to use Jesus so frequently indicates that they were actually writing about events as they were told, because back then he was just referred to as Jesus. Nobody thought of referring to him as Christ. Whereas if you wrote these details later on, you are more likely to use the term Christ and not Jesus. Does that make sense? So this is one more evidence that the Gospels are indeed eyewitness testimony. In fact, if you look at it in terms of recent literature, Google has a tool that allows you to basically search for words across books. So I did a search for Jesus versus Christ, and that pattern pretty much continues until the last couple of decades, where the word Jesus seems to have had more of a use than Christ in literature. So you can see why, for someone, for example, writing in the 1800s, it would make sense to use the term Christ more than someone who's writing about Jesus and about his life as an eyewitness testimony. It would not make sense to use the term Jesus more than Christ. So observations. Christ rapidly became the most common designation no later than AD 50. Again, based on Pauline writing, based on Josephus, based on Pliny, we can make that conclusion. This lends credence to the fact that Gospels are indeed eyewitness recollections, and groups removed from Christianity might not use the designation Jesus at all, because you only hear of him as Christ. So you are less likely to use the word Jesus to refer to him than Christ. Okay, what is Jesus called by others? Again, similar to Simon, we should expect that references to Jesus in the Gospels should be qualified. And that's exactly what we see. Here's an account of Peter, and this is the account when Jesus is being questioned by the temple priests, and Peter's outside, and the girl tells him, "You also were with Jesus the Galilean." Minor detail, but now it makes sense why Jesus would be qualified. Jesus was the sixth most common name, and therefore it makes sense to qualify his name as Jesus the Galilean. Similar account, Matthew 26, also in Mark 14, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. It makes sense that you qualify the name Jesus because it was a popular name. Again, this is Pilate talking. Do you want me to release Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? Again, he's qualifying the name. Another example, Pilate qualifying the name Jesus, who is called Christ. And this is Jesus of Nazareth. And here it is actually the spirits talking. So even the spirits know to qualify, it seems, that this is not just any Jesus. We are talking about Jesus of Nazareth. And this is, again, the account of Bartimaeus, the blind beggar. Even he says, Jesus, when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, not just any Jesus, but Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and said, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me."
That was a qualifier. That was another qualifier.
Yep. Son of David, that would be his. He's basically appealing to his messianic or the messianic prophecy that Jesus came to fulfill. Mark 16, you see Jesus of Nazareth. This is the angel talking to those who came to the tomb. So even the angel seems to qualify his name, not just any Jesus, but you were looking for Jesus of Nazareth. Luke 24, is on the road to Emmaus. The disciples are talking. Jesus comes along and they say, hey, don't you know concerning Jesus of Nazareth? Again, it's qualified. So we see that all of these are qualified. Here's one more. Pilate wrote Jesus of Nazareth on the crucifix. And so all of that makes sense given that Jesus was the most common name. So in public conversation, people seem to qualify his name. The gospel writers are not qualifying it because obviously you know which Jesus they're talking about. But it makes sense. In fact, the only place where he's not qualified, or one place where he's not qualified, this is the thief on the cross. He's saying, Jesus, remember me when you come into the kingdom. And I would say if you're being crucified, brevity of words is probably a good thing. You don't want to talk too much while being crucified. Conserve your energy. What about Jesus and the term that he uses for himself? He uses the term Son of Man, probably referring to prophecies from Ezekiel. And we see that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have a lot of reference to Son of Man. There are some references in Philip, very few references in Thomas, none in Judas and Peter, and a few in Mary. Again, giving credence to the fact that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were people who wrote the gospel accounts with good knowledge about who they were writing within a few decades, and referring to minor details such as names and the qualifications of names. Okay. Rudolf Bultmann makes the claim that there was embellishment of the Gospels, and you see increasing detail. And so let's look at that argument.
Before he does that, real quick, one other, I think, key point about this. What is one more point that makes the articulation or the contention that the Gospels are eyewitness accounts solely by the names that are used for Christ? Remember how this progression went. It did kind of go first in Jerusalem, then Judea, then in Samaria and other parts of the earth. Jesus was articulating what actually ended up happening throughout history. Now, who was the apostle to the Gentiles?
Paul.
Where did Paul go on his missionary journeys? To what type? When he goes and walks into a new city, he goes and stands up where and starts talking about?
Temple first.
Generally starts in the synagogues, occasionally in the marketplace, occasionally on the Areopagus, kind of depends on where it is. But he's principally going to the Jews in these different places. If you're going to the Jews in the different places, number one, if you use the term Messiah in first century Roman-occupied Judah or Israel, what is that a prescription for? Removal of one's head. Yeah, so the Romans were familiar with the concept of the Messiah, which generally meant the one who was expected to throw off the yoke of the oppressor. So when we're talking about Jesus, remember how many Messiahs had arisen? Supposed Messiahs had arisen by Jesus' time. It was several. I mean, Paul and some of the, not Paul, but it's cited around the time of Christ's passion. Do you remember, or right afterwards, do you remember when this guy rose up and he was going to make something of himself, or this one was called the Messiah, and the Maccabees, and you know, shortly thereafter, etc. So the Messiahs were a dime a dozen in Jerusalem at the time, so to speak. Not exactly, but close. So you're talking about a person. You're not even going to qualify him as the Messiah yet. You're talking about that he was powerful in word and deed. He was a prophet. What does that mean? Paul goes and takes the message outside around that time period that Karthik just laid out and says, dear people, diaspora, elsewhere in the Roman Empire, the Messiah has come. If he uses the name Jesus, what does that mean to them?
Nothing.
Joshua, you know, no big deal. I'm telling you about the Messiah. Who is this Messiah? He was called Jesus of Nazareth. But ultimately, remember, every time you're seeing the word Christ, it hits if he uses it in Greek. If he's speaking in Hebrew, he's using Messiah, not Christ. So, interestingly, it both backs up what happened historically and what would have been most reasonable and most probable to happen based on what we knew about the cultural and political norms of the time. So from the idea to get here, I think that Karthik has made really good, is these names are not just a consistency of names or a way to differentiate between other manuscripts, but rather these ones match with the science that we have of the time of saying, how do we know whether this is consistent with what we would expect? And the last thing I'll steal in Karthik's time is, as we're thinking through this, we put on our Christian hats and we say, how do we justify our own scriptures? On the other side, we put on our skeptics' hats and say, what about this stuff? How can we explain? We can explain why people would want to promulgate their own religion. Here's all the different reasons why. The actual neutral ground is to ask this question. We don't know whether these events happened or didn't happen. If they did happen, if we assume that they did happen, what should we expect to see? If we actually, if you want to know what the most objective position is I don't know whether the events happened. If they did happen, what would we have expected to see? And what I believe Karthik is doing is a really good job of making the case that if we take that neutral position, we would expect to see names consistent with what was there historically, differentiations, disambiguations, a difference in how Judean-based people refer to the same person than with somebody off in a province elsewhere in Rome that isn't as familiar with this political situation here. What would we expect to see? So without further ado.
We find two categories of names in the Gospels. There are names of public figures, people of prominence in the government, Herodias, Pilate, and we find the names of disciples. But the people who are unnamed, most of the beneficiaries of healing that Jesus did, in fact, other than Bartimaeus and Lazarus, nobody's mentioned. There are some others mentioned, for example, Jairus, whose daughter was healed, but the daughter's name itself is not mentioned. And people who encountered Jesus once and are not followers. So there seems to be a pattern of who is mentioned and who is not. And last week I showed you this diagram. I want to go through this in a little more detail. This refers to the generally accepted notion that Mark's gospel was the first to be written, and Luke and Matthew had access to Mark's gospel when they wrote their accounts, and John's gospel was the last to be written. The Q over here refers to it's a hypothesis that Luke and Mark had some common material that they referred to. In fact, if you do an analysis of Matthew and Luke, you can see there's a lot of similarity with Mark, but then there's also some common material. For example, some of the narrative related to Jesus' infancy that you find a little bit in Matthew. You find a lot more in Luke, but that's different. But anything that's common in Matthew and Luke is referred to as this Q document, Q being an abbreviation of the word Quell, which in German basically means fragment. So that's the Q document. And then you have the L, the Lucan material. So, for example, the infancy narrative in Luke, the reference to John the Baptist, Zechariah and John the Baptist as he was conceived, and all of that that's not found in other Gospels, that's the Lucan material. And then you have the M material, which is material unique to Matthew, King Herod, the three wise men, all of that is material unique to Matthew. And then you have John. So if there's an increasing amount of embellishment, you would find that Luke and Matthew would add a lot more detail than Mark, and you would assume that John would do the same thing as well. But what we find is that's not the case. We have, so these are the names that are retained by Matthew and Luke that are also present in Mark. These are the names that are changed, and these are the names that are dropped. We find that the vast majority of the names are retained as is. Matthew changes Levi's name. So Levi is a tax collector. He's referred to as Levi by Luke and by Mark. Matthew actually refers to him to that tax collector as Matthew himself. And people believe that was the Matthew that wrote the gospel. Why would that be? Well, perhaps Mark, out of respect, because tax collectors were not thought of as very upright people in that society, decided to take on or use Levi's second name or Matthew's second name, which was Levi, and refer to him as Levi. Luke probably just followed the tradition, but Matthew wanted to reveal that he was a tax collector, and therefore he referred to himself as Matthew. Luke drops Levi's father's name, Alphaeus, but otherwise there's not anything else that's changed. There's nothing changed. And then in terms of names dropped, Jairus, Bartimaeus, Alexander, and Rufus. So these are the sons of, I think, Joseph of Arimathea, I think. And we find that Luke is also dropping some names, Bartimaeus, Alexander, Rufus, and Salome. And if you think of it, especially when Luke talks about talking to eyewitnesses and compiling a report, it could very well be that Luke tried to verify these names, could not come up with any good sources that would confirm that, and just decided to drop it. But it totally undercuts the argument that there was embellishment and that names were added, because clearly names were retained, one name was changed, names were dropped. There was not too much of the whole idea of embellishment.
Apparently I'm constitutionally capable of being quiet.
One other thing that Karthik is hitting on here that I don't want to miss, because it's very important, is the number one critique, remember, go back to his graph of here's all the material, it appears he has just, I think, done a good job of saying there's not increasing detail. But what is there increasing?
Increasing overlap.
Increasing overlap and data. There's more data in the law and the other one. So if the Markan material is this much, when you add Q to Mark, you get a long... So Mark's the shortest gospel. You get longer gospels, and John ends up basically giving you a bunch of detail that none of those other gospels give you. Expected or unexpected? Is that an indication of we're making stuff up, this is legendary material? Or is it an indication of something else? Now, let's try to take the objective stance and let's talk about, brief for 20 seconds, John F. Kennedy. If you're talking to somebody in 1975 about John F. Kennedy, what are you telling? What are the relevant details you're telling them? This guy's president of the United States, he did this, Bay of Pigs maybe, Cuban Missile Crisis, assassinated by this guy. As time goes on, what do we become curious about? Where did Kennedy come from? I mean, we know he's from the Kennedys, but where was he born? What happened? How did he become president? This is not important initially. The initial important stuff is what's the core of what he did and who he was. Then the rest of it is, let's get some clarifying detail on this. Eventually, a biographer writes something about Kennedy and what does it look like? How much of the data of his life is it really talking about when it comes to hard historical points that we care about? Nothing. It's about when he grew up and who he's in love with and what is the poetry that he wrote or whatever. You know, it's those details. If that doesn't look like how the Gospels developed to you, if it doesn't seem to match what we do and we are biographers today, you should take another look at it. I think objectively, that's what it looks like very much to me. And if we ask the question of what should happen, it looks, what would we do today? What would we expect if this were actually the case, it actually happened? The progression of the Gospels, not in the amount of detail that they have, but in the scope, matches very closely what we do today.
But it does undercut the argument that there are four independent, distinct histories of Jesus' life and time.
If there were, absolutely, but if there are only 12, if there are only 12 disciples, do you expect to see overlap of source material?
Sure, but you can't, but when you go back to your argument and you're showing the names and you're going, well, look at the book of Matthew, look at the book of Mark, look at the book of John, look at these statistical similarities between them, and you use that to make your case for historical accuracy, that's a little bit disingenuous because there is source material.
I'll tell you why. You wrote Kennedy's original biography.
Right.
I want to write a biography that talks not just about Kennedy's core stuff that he did, but I also want to talk about Kennedy's relationship to Jackie. Well, I got two choices. I do all my research from zero, or I work off of this document that gives me a framework off of which to move. Which one am I going to do? Why start from zero again? Now, I'm going to go back and check your primary sources, make sure that you're not making stuff up, but that's what Karthik's talking about happening.
Yeah, it's all apply statistical analysis to it and go, look at these. Because they are common, that means it is true, or that means it is valid. When you have that, you have to exclude that source material.
That's correct. That's correct. So, as Professor Tomlinson has noted earlier in class. So the question that now we do need an analysis of the statistical method to agree.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's also worth noting that Gospels get critiqued both ways. When some of the accounts, for example, as far as like locating the empty tomb, don't line up exactly because they name different women going to the tomb. They don't say this is a full account of all the women. They don't match up perfectly. Then they say, hey, these aren't in harmony. Hey, these aren't exactly the same. Right?
Right.
And they get critiqued because there's differences. But when they're the same, they get critiqued from the perspective of one copy of the other. So when there's differences in them, they're critiqued as couldn't possibly be harmonized. When they're the same, you just copied that, and that doesn't count as an additional source.
And we haven't really talked about it here, but the hard part of that is when you take it the next step and go, the Gospels are inerrant. Because when you see the distinctions, when you see the
Some of the things that you
agreed, but other class.
Yes. Next class. Next class, we'll make a leap into inerrancy.
That's a whole different.
But to your point,
this is all just about is this reliable history?
Yes.
Period.
Right.
We'll go elsewhere from there later. Yeah.
But to your point, the Q material has no names because it's mostly the sayings of Jesus. Now, Q material is common to Matthew and Luke. The Lucan material has names. So we have Zacchaeus, Elizabeth, Zechariah, Joanna, Susanna. So there are names. But it still doesn't lend any credence to adding more detail.
Right.
Adding more detail would be if you took Mark's material and added names to his detail. That we don't find. John also has four exclusive names. Malchus, the person whose ears were cut off, is named in John but unnamed in the others. Again, something like that can be explained. If you consider the fact that John was the last person to write the gospel, perhaps by then Malchus became a believer and he started telling people that he was the person whose ear Peter cut off and who Jesus healed. So that makes perfect sense then. And then most of the named characters are around Jerusalem. That makes sense again because the early church was established around Jerusalem. So it would make sense that people who encountered Christ and who later on came to faith would identify themselves and tell the writers of the Gospels about those events and would identify themselves by name. So it makes perfect sense that the people who are named, most of them would be from Jerusalem. Okay, I'm going to go through one more point, and which is the names of the 12 disciples themselves. And the names are found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They're not found in John, and they're also referred to in Acts. And my argument over here is very simple, that if the Gospels were written later on, all you would have to do is refer to them as John, one of the 12, James, one of the 12. And in fact, they are referred to that by that designation by Paul in a couple of places. But my point is that the names as represented in the Gospels, when the names of the 12 were names that they took on before they became famous, so to speak. And so let's look at it. All four of the accounts have Simon Peter as the first person listed. That makes sense because there was the idea that Peter was the head and Christ seemed to anoint him as the head. Skipping down to the end, Judas Iscariot is the last person listed in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in Acts, he's not referred to at all because this is in context of naming the 12th. And by then, Judas is already dead. Nobody thinks of him as an apostle anyway. But it makes sense that Judas would be the last person referred to. So you can see that this is perhaps an account of the 12 looking back in history. So it makes sense that you write Peter as the first name and Judas Iscariot as the last name. But when you look at it, here you have Andrew. Andrew was not a very common name. It's not qualified. Andrew. But James was a common name. That's qualified. James, the son of Zebedee. John, his brother. John is qualified by being as referred to as the brother of James. So that is qualification. Some of the other examples. You have this Judas is interesting. Judas, the son of James, referred to as by Luke as Judas in both places, is now changed to Thaddeus by Matthew and Mark, which would make sense. Judas perhaps had a nickname of Thaddeus. That's a Greek name. And so it makes sense that to try and differentiate him from Judas Iscariot, the infamous one, they would refer to him as by a different name. But you can also see that Simon the Zealot is qualified. And so my argument is simply that Simon the Zealot was his name, and that's how he was referred to while he was with Christ before he became famous. Because otherwise, the other Simon has already become Peter. All you have to do to refer to Simon is say Simon, one of the 12. And so this again shows that the gospel writers were trying to accurately capture the life of the 12 and of Christ as it happened, including minor details such as how they were referred to while they were with Jesus before they became the apostles. All right. We've talked about names. What about some other aspects of life in Jerusalem and life in Israel? What about names of places? In the Gospels, we have 66 references to Jerusalem, 21 to Nazareth, a whole bunch to Capernaum, some more names, Bethany, Bethlehem, Bethsaida, Jericho, Sidon, Tyre. These are referred to between 5 and 12 times, and then some other cities are referred to a few times. How does that compare with the other Gospels? The Gospel of Philip, Jerusalem, and Nazareth. The rest of them, Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Savior, Gospel of Mary, they only refer to Jerusalem. And other 2nd and 3rd century Gospels don't have any references to any places in them. Do you think that lends credence to the fact that these Gospel writers, the four Gospels that we have, are perhaps eyewitness testimony? I would think so. Because you would think that if you're writing a detailed account, you would have names of places that people went to. So the complete lack of any kind of detail about the geography of that place, of first century Israel, is, I think, a big point against these Gospels. Okay, this chart is really small, but I'm going to try and explain this. So this is a view of the various Gospels that we have. So this is the Gospels that we accepted, the book of Acts, and these are the Gospels that we don't accept as valid. And the references to these Gospels by early church fathers. So this is Ignatius, Polycarp, Marcion, Valentinus, Justin Martin, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, and so on and so forth. So Ignatius, Polycarp, Marcion, Valentinus, they were pretty much 1st century, 2nd century. These guys, Justin Martin through, I think this is Tertullian, these guys are 2nd and 3rd century. This is the Muratorian canon. It's basically a collection of the books that were considered authoritative that was compiled about the 2nd century. Moving forward, Origen, Eusebius, and so forth. We're going into the 2nd century, and these are more of the 3rd and 4th century. So we find that, and by the way, the legend, if you have a checkbox, that means they refer to these materials, and they refer to them in an approving way. The X means they refer to the material, but they are basically arguing against the authority of these books. And so if you see, there's a clear indication that none of the early church fathers referred to any of the Gospels that we have rejected. There's almost unanimous acceptance to the four Gospels. Marcion and Valentinus stand out in that Marcion rejected all of the material, and Valentinus seems to have accepted the Gospel of Truth, one of the documents, but that's very easy to explain. These two were considered heretics. In fact, I think it was not Origen, but one of the guys wrote a prologue saying against Marcion, and Marcion and Valentinus were of the Gnostic thought. And so for Marcion, any reference to the humanity of Jesus was considered to be rubbish. So he went through and destroyed all of the references to Jesus as human, and so he had more of the idea of docetism, that Jesus was really God, but there was appearance of a human, perhaps. So Marcion and Valentinus were really rejected by all of the early church fathers. Any references to them are always in the negative. So you can see that there's unanimous acceptance of the four Gospels and the book of Acts very early on, and none of the other Gospels had that same kind of privilege and acceptance in the early church. So I would say all of these arguments lend credence to the fact that this is really an eyewitness testimony. And I'm going to close with one final argument. That's the idea of undesigned coincidence. If you have a multitude of accounts of a particular event, you would expect that people would state things that taken by itself would make no sense. But when you take the accounts together, you'd be able to, almost like a puzzle, put things together and make sense of a particular statement. And I'm going to give you one example of that. Again, the basic idea is four people witnessed an account, wrote down about it, and they wrote things that by themselves don't seem to make a lot of sense. But when you look at all four accounts, you can thread an explanation through all those accounts and make sense of the whole. And there are a number of different examples in the Gospels. I'm going to show you one example. The feeding of the 5,000. This is the one miracle that appears in all four Gospels. And we'll start off with John chapter 6, verse 5. May I have a volunteer read this?
Jesus, therefore, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a great multitude cometh unto him, saith unto Philip, whence are we to buy bread that these may eat?
Okay. So Jesus and the 12 are away, and they're trying to find a source of food. There are 5,000 people gathered around, and they're trying to figure out where can we get bread from. I had a slide with this. Okay. And Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread? The question is, why did he turn to Philip? Philip is hardly the most prominent apostle in the narratives. It's really Peter, the disciple whom Jesus loved, James, John. So why did he turn to Philip? If you read through John, you're not going to be able to answer that. But the question is answered when you look at Luke chapter 9, verses 10 and 11, where we get this little detail that on the return, the apostles told them about all that he had done, and he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. And so we now know through Luke that the feeding of the 5,000 happened near a town called Bethsaida. That's good, but I haven't answered my question, why Philip? Well, if you read elsewhere in John 12:21, it says, so these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida. Now it makes sense as to why Jesus would turn to Philip and ask him to go get bread, or, what was the question again?
Where's
a good place to buy bread? Because Philip is from Bethsaida. That makes perfect sense now. But reading that particular verse in John by itself, you would be hard-pressed to answer why did he turn to Philip. But by looking at Luke and by looking at elsewhere in John, we're able to stitch together a complete picture. Okay, it makes sense to ask Philip. He's from that area. Okay. There's also this detail that those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides men and women. And that makes sense because in Mark, we are told that they were seated by hundreds and fifties. So it makes sense that, now obviously no one I think is going to argue that it was exactly 5,000. The people said there were about 5,000. And it makes sense if you seat them by hundreds and fifties that you'd be able to come up with a quick estimate of how many people there are. And so that little detail that is found in Matthew is further qualified in Mark. So we know how you can arrive at the number of people as being 5,000. But Mark also refers to the green grass. And you can say, okay, you know, when you think about Israel, you don't necessarily think about lush green grass. So how do you explain this? Well, Mark elsewhere talks about that while they were there, there were a lot of people coming and going. Why were there a lot of people coming and going? Because John says that this was near the Passover. So it was near the Passover, it was about the time of the Passover when the feeding of the 5,000 happened. And so now we can look at the precipitation in nearby Tiberias. This is the chart of rainfall, annual rainfall. And we know that the Passover would have occurred in April. And so we can see after 5 months of good rainfall, we can say, okay, that would be probably some really good green grass. So it all fits together. Again, the idea being we are able to take different detail from the Gospels and stitch them together and explain statements that by themselves don't make any sense. In addition, in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says, woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida, for if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented a long time ago. Matthew's Gospel does not tell you what happened in Bethsaida. But now we know, because of the other Gospels, that the feeding of the 5,000 did indeed happen in Bethsaida. So now we can understand what this statement even means. So Matthew has just recorded his statement as is. He's not given any explanation of why or what about Bethsaida, what happened there. But we're able to stitch the pieces together and come up with an explanation of why Bethsaida. All right, I'm going to stop here. We have 5 minutes left. Any questions? I know I went through a lot of material and probably really quick. But I think the main point I want you to take away is that the gospel writers were effective in capturing difficult to remember details like names, like names of places, names of people, names of places, and therefore we can have confidence that perhaps they also got the major details of Christ's life correct. And that's what it comes down to. And when we're making the full argument, what we really want to take away from this is that because of the accuracy of the information or the general reliability of the Gospels, we can perhaps hold to some basic facts such as the empty tomb, the witness of the empty tomb by the disciples, and looking at Acts, the conversion of the disciples from a bunch of guys who got really scared and hid to people who came out and started preaching against the established leaders of Judaism. And now you have to thread, okay, what is the best explanation for an empty tomb, for empty tomb witnesses? And when you string all of that data together, and Will will be doing that in 2 weeks' time, you are, right? Okay. We come to the conclusion that the best explanation is the resurrection. And if the best explanation is the resurrection, then Jesus Christ is God. And if Jesus Christ is God, then we can proceed from that point and start looking at the inerrancy of Scripture. And that's where we'll go next week. We'll try to make this transition from general reliability of the Gospels to inerrancy. And I'll, as I make that argument, I'm also going to tell you why you should not make that argument with people who do not believe Jesus is Lord. Because otherwise, it's an argument you'll never win. You're claiming that something is without error, and it's not a mathematical proposition that you're trying to present where you can show a proof. And therefore, there is a particular way that's only accessible if you accept the deity of Christ.
A bunch of terrific information Carthy gives today. You're talking to somebody that is asking about Christianity, they're curious about, and they've heard, and they want to question the reliability of the Christian scriptures. Can you give them all this data? Probably not, right? It's not going to happen. What's a short way that we can talk about the reliability of the Gospels as eyewitness accounts? This is how I do it. This is how I did it at lunch with an older gentleman this last week. It's enough to cause them to say, my assumptions may not be correct. Maybe I need to look into it more deeply. If they get an appetite for it, then this type of excellent scholarship is what one needs to do. But this is how I do it. I use a little bit of my old Marine Corps stuff, but you can use police as an example. Cops pull over 4 guys in a car. What's the first thing they do? They think they may have committed a crime. What are they going to have done once they pull the guy over? What's the first thing you get on the radio and do? Call for backup. So they get backup on there. They close with the car. They get everybody out. What's the next thing that they do?
Separate
them. Why?
Can't coordinate their story.
Can't get their story straight. Now, you talk to all 4 different guys, and somebody may have held up a 7-Eleven. You ask the first guy, where have you been? I went to my friend Billy's house. Then we went to go to this pool hall. We hung out there for a minute. Then we went there. Then we went to here. You ask the next guy, what happened? Went to Billy's house initially. Then we went to a pool hall. They give you the exact same story. It sounds almost verbatim. What do you know? This is a made-up story. It's a made-up story. When you ask all 4 guys where you've been, and all of them give wildly disparate accounts, none of which fit in at all, what do you know? Each one of the guys is trying to independently lie because they know they can't tell the truth, but they're not sure what the other dudes are saying. What happens when you get 4 different views of a story, especially if it's consistent with what the person reports as their own viewpoint? Will they disagree in the details?
Yes.
Yes, they will. Some of that is perspective. Some of it is where they're coming from, etc. But in the same way that cops know the difference between a true set of eyewitness accounts and a false, by they either cohere, they are too much a facsimile of each other, or alternately, there's no common ground amongst them. Those are the extremes. Those which lie within the center is where truth lies, when you're doing good police work. So don't, like Karthik says, we're not talking about inerrancy. Leave inerrancy out when you're talking to anybody outside of Christianity. Talk about it from their own perspective, which is good police work, good historical work, good scholarship. When you do that, you will find, just like we did with science, that it is going to be, in this guy's estimation anyway, more probably or plausibly true than not that these were reasonable eyewitness accounts of what happened. Then you have to deal with the history. And now you have to worry about that. But again, for another time, we'll do some of that and we'll do some of that later.
And my PowerPoint is I posted the PowerPoint to the Solid Ground class. I also have a 60-page document that has all of the data that I've talked about, including references. So just go to the Solid Ground class, the Solid Ground 2012-2013 group in CCB and download it. I've got references to all of the material that I'm sourcing from, and all of this data is there. So.